Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hello, everybody. Our conversation about the promise of American capitalism continues. We talked earlier about Republicans going after each other over Mitt Romney's so-called vulture capitalism at Bain Management. Now let's talk about another hallmark of American capitalism, manufacturing jobs and the American middle class. Adam Davidson, who you know from NPR's Planet Money, has the cover story in this month's Atlantic magazine profiling one plant that may hold clues about the future of manufacturing and blue-collar jobs here in the United States. Adam, welcome back. How you doing?
Hey, Brian. Thanks so much.
Your piece starts with a pretty simple hard stat. Over the past decade, manufacturing output has gone up by a third in this country, but manufacturing jobs have dropped by about the same percentage. What does that mean?
So, you know, there's this thing people say, oh, manufacturing's dead in America. We don't make anything anymore in America. And that is not true. Depending on the statistics are a little confusing, but we're either number one or number two, and China is the other number one or number two, depending on where we stand. But what we make tends to be highly value-added products, you know, really precision parts. So most of the consumer goods that we have in our homes or that we, you know, that we interact with on a day-to-day basis are indeed made, no longer made in America, but really precision stuff from autos to aerospace to, you know, medical equipment, that stuff, a lot of that is made here. So the dollar value of what we make keeps going up and up and up, which is very good news, not just for the 1%, you know, the owners of capital, but for, you know, you and me, people with 401ks, people who own, who have stock options, or I mean, who have stock plans, et cetera. But the way the U.S. competes is by doing extremely high-value stuff with very few workers, replacing workers with machinery.
But that sounds like a redistribution of wealth from workers to owners. If our output in manufacturing is going up, but it means fewer and fewer jobs at the same time, why is that a good thing?
I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, I think it's just what's happening. I mean, there's not really a way, you know, if you imagine two factories competing, you know, head to head for customers making the exact same thing, one factory's in America, one factory's in China. If the American factory pursued a high labor plan, if they decided, you know, we're just going to employ a lot of people because that's good for America, then that's just not a way they could possibly compete with a factory in China where labor is much, much cheaper. So what America does instead is, you know, it uses machinery, uses capital, not money capital, but, you know, physical capital, big machines, high quality machines. Now, those machines need workers, so it's not that there are no workers. Those workers are different workers. They're highly skilled workers. They're, you know, they know lots of really technical, specialized things about how these machines work, how the metals that these machines cut, you know, the metallurgy of those metals, things like that. And so it's, you know, when you say redistribution of wealth, I think of that as like a centrally planned government choice. You know, this is the chaotic market choice of millions and millions of factory managers and factory owners.
Right. Well, the market can redistribute wealth as well as a centrally planned government. But if we are the number one manufacturer or number two manufacturer in the world in terms of output, I wonder what you think when you hear politicians talk like this. Here's a mashup of statements from within the last year about the loss of manufacturing in America. Rick Santorum, President Obama, Newt Gingrich, John Huntsman, in that order.
Creating energy jobs, creating manufacturing jobs, and my plan will do that.
Renew the promise of American manufacturing to help make sure America remains in this century what we were in the last, a country that makes things.
Hard idea for Washington reporters to cover, but an important idea because it's the key to American manufacturing success.
It used to mean something when you read Made in America. We don't make things anymore in this country.
We don't make things anymore in this country, said John Huntsman wistfully there. Is he just pandering? Does he not know the stats you were just citing?
I got to say, I mean, this drives me absolutely crazy. I mean, pandering. I mean, what I always wonder with, when politicians say stuff like that, is it worse to imagine they're ignorant or that they're pandering? I don't know. But yes, we make many, many things. We make a lot of high-value things. It's not just a shift from labor to capital. This story, in my mind, is not a 99-1 story. It's more like a 50-50 story. That this story overall is good news for people with education. That doesn't mean college education or PhDs or engineers, although it's very good for those people too. You know, it means people with a two-year technical degree from a technical college, that kind of thing. And that is what in the Atlantic article that I wrote, what I really learned and what I really wanted to highlight. I think the major shift is not that we don't make things anymore. It's that we don't make things that require huge numbers of unskilled labor. And I think that's the key in my mind. That's the shift we have right now.
And let's talk about the plant that you profiled in the Atlantic piece, Standard Motor Plants in Greenville, South Carolina, where a lot of the candidates are in the Greenville area right now. Auto Products, 92 years old, family run, and doing pretty well?
Doing okay. Standard Motor Products, they're based here in Long Island City in Queens. Until a few decades ago, they made everything here in Queens, all their auto parts. They kept making things in Queens much longer than their investors would have liked. My sense from getting to know the family, the Sills family that still runs the business 92 years later, they do take their responsibility to their workers very seriously. And I wanted to show that even with a very sympathetic owner, even with an owner who's not looking to squeeze every penny of profit out of the worker, there's really no way for them to just maintain massive numbers of unskilled workers. They do have, something like 60% of their workforce is what would be called unskilled. That basically means someone who could be trained to do what they do in a day, as opposed to the highly skilled people where you really need several years of training to do what they do. And so it's not that there are no unskilled jobs, it's just that there are fewer and fewer, and when you look out in the future, there will continue to be fewer and fewer and fewer, which means that there are lots of people in America, 80 million by one estimate, who it's just hard to see what economically valuable activity there is going to be going forward. And that is awful. That, you ask what's good or bad. That's mm-hmm. clearly bad, although it's not quite clear what the solution would be.
Well, is there internal mobility? You profile one worker in particular, Maddie Parlier, who is very much set on working her way up the ranks from unskilled.
Nobody in South Carolina is Parlier. It's Parlier. Yeah.
Parlier.
yeah.
Parlier, unskilled to highly skilled to management. That's the career path that she wants to pursue. Is there opportunity for her to do that?
So this was another big insight for me that I found very powerful, is that if you think of old manufacturing plants, whether it's a textile mill in South Carolina or a steel mill or an auto parts plant, for most of the early industrialization of America, from, say the 1890s to the 1990s, you would come in with very little skill, often without even a high school degree, but you could gradually learn skills on the job. And so if you saw the older people who were highly skilled, who tended to be fairly well paid, in South Carolina, they said, the sign of being a successful textile worker was you had a home, a car, and a boat, and that meant you had made it. And lots of people who start high school dropouts, who just started as entry-level workers, developed the skills that allowed them to command those wages. But now the gulf between the unskilled and the skilled is so huge. There's so much technical stuff you need to do that someone like Maddie, 23-year-old, incredibly bright, incredibly ambitious, you can just tell talking to her, this is a person who is built to succeed, but she has two kids, she's a single mother, her family does not have the resources to support her, and to get that next step up would require her leaving the workforce, or leaving her kids in some precarious situation, going to school for several years. And that's just a barrier for so many people in America. That's just not something that can happen. So the absence of that on-the-job training, that's just a very upsetting issue for so many people.
Adam Davidson from NPR's Planet Money team. He has the cover story in this month's Atlantic magazine. profiling one plant that may hold clues about the future of manufacturing and blue-collar jobs here in the United States. 212-433-WNYC. And Claire in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hi. Love you. My concern is that there are U.S. legislated international trade agreements such as NAFTA and a lot of other ones with many other countries in the world. And I'm just wondering why, when this subject comes up, doesn't anybody ever talk about the fact that a lot of the loss of manufacturing in the U.S. has been mandated by agreements that the United States government has made with these other countries?
Adam, where does government decision-making on this as a matter of intentionality, if you will, with NAFTA and other agreements come in?
I think I generally go with the vast majority of economists, even, you know, Paul Krugman, left-leaning economists, which is that, as a general principle, trade is a very good thing overall. It definitely causes localized pain for some people and painful adjustments, but the opposite is even worse. So America would most likely be, you know, all of us, including the unskilled, would be in much worse shape if we weren't able to take advantage of the full world. Not to mention China. I mean, this doesn't come up much in the American discussion, but the fact that hundreds of millions of people have left abject, miserable poverty to just sort of miserable poverty. I mean, I don't want to be Pollyanna.
Yeah,
about
well, it's the whole complicated global question of rural poverty to urban poverty in China and many other countries that's
To China, it's not a complicated question for the Chinese who have urban poverty. They prefer it to rural poverty. They prefer the opportunities. But the thing that I would note, though, is a true free trade agreement would be on a postcard. It would just be you trade, we trade. And we don't have that. We have thousands of page documents, NAFTA and our WTO accession agreements, et cetera. These do tend to protect the highly educated. You know, they're very obsessed with intellectual property, with keeping foreign doctors out, with keeping foreign financial services firms with keeping foreign airlines from competing with American domestic firms. They're very focused on protecting the highly skilled, the highly educated. They're much less focused, or not focused hardly at all, on protecting the poor. And so what that means is the poorly educated, the poor, do bear a disproportionate brunt of, you know, not free trade, managed global trade.
Right.
And I think that if we did have true free trade, that could benefit everyone because medical care would be cheaper, transportation would be cheaper, all sorts of things would be cheaper for the poor and the rich, although, you know, some of the more highly educated people would not benefit.
Related to that, I think, is Bernard in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hello, Bernard.
Hi. As I said before, my name is Bernard, and I live in Brooklyn. We continue to buy our products overseas where there is no or hardly any environmental or labor laws, right? In the meantime, we are exporting pollution and risk to labor. When is our government going to put in the cost of this environmental stuff towards the exporting nations?
Bernard, thank you. Adam, do they ever try to cost that in, factor that in to the economics of it?
That's certainly, you know, an idea that exists out there. I think it's safe to say the current Congress and, you know, this year, that's not going to be something that our political leaders in Washington even glancingly consider. I do think that China is in the process of shifting from the most troubling global leader in pollution, which they still are, but is shifting towards taking environmental issues seriously. Some would argue much more seriously than we do. So I think stay posted. But yeah, that is the big question. It's very hard to manage these things in a global economy.
But before you go, I think we need to talk about the role of education. You conclude your article by saying that we might be better off focusing on getting someone like Mattie Perlier the education and training she needs to climb the ladder, rather than trying to bring back low-skilled manufacturing jobs. And yet a debate has broken out in this country over President Obama saying recently that everybody should get a college education or should be able to get a college education in the United States. And there's been a backlash against that. Some people accusing the president of having a lot of hubris for suggesting such a thing. But if we're going to make the kinds of deals that you've been describing, giving up on low-skill manufacturing jobs and moving toward these high-skill manufacturing jobs and other educated for jobs being protected, then we almost as a nation have to come up with a policy to educate almost everybody, don't we?
Or at least get out of the way. I mean, I think, you know, the local base, you know, funding education through local property taxes, which creates, you know, highly educated people having highly educated children in rich suburbs and the opposite in urban centers, is clearly a disaster. Education is a tricky thing because, you know, we're also in a period where a college degree is no longer a guarantee of a middle class wage and a middle class life. But yes, I mean, I would say that, without endorsing any particular education policy, I think there are market-based yeah. solutions, there's government-based solutions, there's local solutions, there's national solutions. But in my mind, there's no way to discuss the future competitiveness of America, the inequality in America, without education being number one or number two of the issues you're discussing. It is one of, obviously, just one of the key things. Part of that, though, is targeting education, which I think, you know, I grew up in West Beth and Greenwich Village, all artist housing, I'm right now writing a column for the New York Times about the fact that liberal arts education really doesn't seem to have much bang for the buck, that you know, you might need to get an engineering degree, a math degree, something that's really directly applicable. So it's a very complicated picture, but absolutely, education's the key.
And I guess, though you don't mention Bain or Mitt Romney in your piece, it's the same underlying anxieties that are leading Newt Gingrich and some of his other rivals to try to go after Bain the way that they are, whether it's accurate or not. It's the fear that capitalism is no longer there to create jobs and take care of the middle class.
Capitalism has never been – I mean, capitalism isn't the kind of thing that cares about whether there are jobs. I mean, capitalism is a – you know, the best selling point for capitalism is it creates an efficient use of capital, which might mean more jobs, might be fewer jobs. It's neutral on that issue. It's neutral on whether there's a middle class or not, although generally where there is capitalism, you see middle class, and where there isn't, you don't. I don't know enough about the main capital issue, but I would say that these are major macroeconomic global trends. I think they are much bigger than any private equity firm or even any president. I mean, I think it's naive to imagine that this is the result of the decisions of a handful of people who you could name and make commercials about and beat up on. These are, you know, this is what happens when much of the world, China, India, Brazil, Russia, much of the world that was just kept away from industrialization, kept away from progress, is brought on. It changes the very nature of work everywhere. And I don't know that there's some bundle of solutions that would have, you know, just made this seamless and easy and not painful for so many Americans. That's not to say there's not jerks out there who made this worse for people, or government policy that made it much worse, or government policy that made it much better. I don't want to write off the guilty, whoever they may be. But I'm just saying, I don't know that at its core, there's like a guilty party who we should blame for this.
I just want to acknowledge for the Adam Davidson fans in our audience, or those who remember his last appearance on this show, that he was on full baby alert at that time and might have had to break the interview short right in the middle of our conversation if his wife went into labor. So that baby has been born. Adam, congratulations. And how exactly did you and your wife pick the name Blue Ivy? Oh, wait a minute. Wrong famous birth. But congratulations.
Thank you very much, Brian.
I hope you're getting some sleep.
Not much.
Adam Davidson from NPR's Planet Money team has the cover story in The Atlantic this month, profiling one plant that may hold clues about the future of manufacturing and blue-collar jobs in the United States. Thanks again.